Thank you all for having me here today, and it's been an amazing experience to be here for the last couple of days, and I believe there's so much I've learned the last couple of days that I've changed my notes three times, so I'm actually really happy I didn't submit them initially. My name is Aris Katasilaris, and I'm overseeing the work of 8-in-1 in Greece. I have to admit that reducing demand and identification is probably the things that I'd say I'm most passionate about recently, because in the recent years we just really saw the importance of or the demand plays in, and also the importance of identifying and rescuing survivors. So I do, before we dive into the identification, especially within the irregular migration kind of movement that we've been experiencing lately, I would want to just establish some common ground. And I'm going to try to do that initially with three kind of bases to start talking about this today. The first question is, and actually I want to congratulate our friend from Portugal yesterday, who very bravely brought a very valid question. We have a man who is not able to get sex through a normal relationship with a woman, and we have a woman who is willing to give that to him for an exchange of money. Why should we stop that? I think that's a very valid question we should all be asking. And it's brave to bring it up in an audience like this. So congratulate you for that, man. But I want to ask these questions, though. Let's try to answer it all together. And I'm more used to a classroom setting, so I may require some interaction from you guys, if that's okay. But let's try to estimate. We're not doing statistics, and a lot of you may be in analytics, and you hate what I'm about to do. But let's say, how many people in Greece right now? How many women in Greece would be willing to give their sex to sell it for money? Would you say 1% of the population? I don't know. Like, let's put a number to it, right? Half percentage? Like, let's say a number. Let's say 2,000. Would that be okay? Yeah. Let's say, all right. Why don't we take parents. How many parents in Greece right now would be okay with their daughter doing that? Maybe less. Well, some people should be, right? If it's a free thing, then, you know, whatever. But most people would not want that for their daughters, right? Let's take now these numbers and contrast them in a different way. So let's put Switzerland, for example. Do we have anybody from Switzerland here? That's a great place to be. So Switzerland is our example for today. How many women would be willingly giving themselves in Switzerland today? Would you say, let's throw a number in there. It depends on how much, of course. I mean, but that depends in every country, right? That is in every country. So let's say, I'll put a number in there, because it's, for this exercise, it will not make a difference. So let's say 1,000 women today in Switzerland, the Swiss women that want to just do that, they decided it's an easy way of living, right? And how many parents would say in Switzerland today would be happy? Probably like very little, right? Let's take now these numbers and try to get them out of a country like Burma, or Laos, or the Dominican Republic, or Bulgaria, or Africa, Nigeria. How many women would you say there? If I said 10,000, would you say it's too much? No. If I said 30,000, would you say it's too much? No. How many parents would be okay sending their kids to do that so they support their families? If I said 1,000, would you say it's too much? 10,000 is too many parents.
No, we'll
get to that. What I want to say is this. If we accepted the will, we're talking about the willing now, right? So obviously there's different opinions. Some people say there's nobody that is willing. Some people say that there is some that is willing. What I think we all agree on is that even the ones that were willing, if they are willing, and if they're not, we can fight that later, there would be much less of them in the Western world. And in a well-functioning society, you'll find much less victims of human trafficking. And in a not-so-functioning society, you'll find much more. So, or not victims of human trafficking, sorry, willing prostitutes, people that are willing to give themselves. So I think we can admit that there is a link between vulnerability and availability. I don't want to make that a provocative topic, but it is as it is, so whether you think the willing or not, I think that willingness is affected heavily based on the vulnerability in the society that this person is brought up in. Now, if we agree on that, let's move on to the next part, which is, human trafficking is a crime of people. And I think we know that, we've talked about it, so I'm not going to get to the basics. There's people selling people to other people. So there's three key groups of people that we can kind of like talk address in that, and it's the customers, right? The prostitutes willing or the victim, the trafficked victims, right? They're the product. And then we have the people profiting from that, right? Whether that is industries, businessmen, or traffickers, or pimps, you know, whoever it is. We have three different groups of people. Now, I want us to make that argument there. The customers, we're talking about the demand. The customers are the customers of that create this kind of profit that forces an industry like this are not the perverts. They're not the people that want to go with a broken person. And they're not, and I will argue actually with you too, that it's not the people that can't find sex through a normal relationship. If you go to the brothels tonight in Thessaloniki, which actually I hope you guys did in your not to go visit them, but just to go see what's happening, you'll see people driving their Mercedes with probably like a little icon of Holy Mary on the dashboard and the pictures of the kids and the mothers and their families and their wives. They're the ones producing the money. The perverts and the sick people and the people that can't access sex, there are not that many that will generate the profits that this industry needs to move. Who agrees on that? Does anyone agree with that? I've got three people in the audience. Thank you. The third point I want to make is this. It's a profiting business. And let's try to see it from, before we get into identification and all that, which I will try to just really get the perspective of the survivor, I want us to get into the survivor of the businessman, right? What is driving business? Profit, right? Risk versus profit. We know the statistics for punishment. We know the numbers of profit. Second most profitable crime in the world, right? What is the profit limiting factors? What limits the profit a businessman can make? I think you touched on that before. How much somebody is willing to pay, right? That's something that limits the profit. So if I'm a business, I need to see how much is he willing to make? What's the kind of effort I need to put in? What else? How much does employment work pay, worth? How much do I need to pay a legal prostitute to work again, have her registered and do all that? How much does that cost? Because the more I pay her, the less I make, right? And then what's the third limiting factor? If in Switzerland right now, there is 1,000 women that are willingly, I'm not talking about victim human trafficking, willingly wanting to do that, how many men are buyers of sex in Switzerland today? If I said 1 million, it's a small country, let's say 500,000. Would that be normal? Like, I mean, I'm talking about not human trafficking, just sexual services, right? Maybe, right? How could these women ever cover that demand? They can't. So then that's another limiting factor. The number of willing women is a limiting factor to the profits that the business is going to make. So what's our options here? Maybe we have many options. If somebody's more entrepreneurial than me, maybe he can come up with other things too. But I think we can either go and outsource the oil for our engine, the products that we need. Where can we find it? In more vulnerable societies, more dysfunctioning communities that produce vulnerable people. So let's go and outsource it, bring from there people that are willing. We're talking about the willing people, right? Or why don't we, but willing people still have the rights. So how can we minimize both that and the amount of money we pay them so we increase profits? Let's go produce some willing people. I've used the word willingness all this time, and I haven't used the word consent, because I think that sometimes when we associate words with our arguments, and as soon as we hear consent, you have formed your own argument about that, and then somebody else has formed the other argument, and we're talking about this. But I think that at the end of the day, that's what it is. The risk analysis in this, it's positive towards, this is a good business model. This is a good profit-making industry. And we can do that. Now, we exploit vulnerability either because people are vulnerable, more vulnerable in different places of the world, or we just find the vulnerable among our own community and we traffic them. Now, it's not a surprise that the industry is the second largest profiting organized crime in the world. And as our demand for sex grows every year, with internet porn, with sexual services being more available than ever, with a new generation growing, with a tradition of bachelor parties and, you know, all that stuff going on, it's not a surprise that the industry is growing. Meanwhile, the cost of legal employment is rising, limiting the profits that a business can make. And at the same time, there's multitudes of vulnerable people. I think these are ideal circumstances for human trafficking to exist within the sex industry. And my argument today is not, I'm not saying that, I wasn't invited here as an expert in policy, first of all, so anything I say, take it with a grain of salt. And then second, I think that, I'm not saying criminalize it or regulate it. I'm not saying the Swedish model is better than the Dutch or the Dutch is better than the German. What I'm saying, whatever model you're using, we're going to actually accept that demand for sexual services does drive demand for human trafficking, whether it's directly or indirectly. It creates the conditions for ideal market conditions for human traffickers. Now, I do believe that effectively reducing demand is probably the most effective and long-lasting way of going about eradicating human trafficking. And I firmly believe that. Now, whether the sex industry is going to outsource it or produce it, the willingness is generated and we need to identify it. And I'm going to move on to identification. I think whether it is that somebody's going to recruit and make victims of human trafficking, or he's going to go to Moldova, Nigeria, or Dominican Republic and recruit them to bring them over, we still need to identify both of them. So I want to move on to identification. And now, in 2012, we started a hotline in Greece, the 1109. And sparked from your idea, if you actually go to the airport when you go out tonight, look for the posters. They're sitting there behind the police checks. A blue and white one, and then a more dark one that has a woman with a little thing, a hand over her nose, which I know you don't agree, but that's fine. We can live with that. It's an old campaign. In the next ones, we'll improve that. But we started this hotline, and then the next year, seeing all this information and seeing how some cases are handled, we started training the police. And we went to the police headquarters in Athens, and we said, we're an NGO. We don't know much, but we do get to spend a lot of time with survivors of human trafficking, sometimes 6 months, sometimes 3 months, sometimes a year. And we get to know stuff that you will never be able to find out in 48 hours about how this works and all that. So the police was very willing. And immediately, we had the first discussion in July, and then from September onward, we've been doing lectures in the academy and the further education school, and we've been organizing day seminars all over the country. We've trained more than 1,300 officers of the law enforcement since 2013. And we developed this model in order to try to get them to see it from the perspective of the survivor. And that's what I want to put up on the screen today. And quickly try to get us all to see it from the eyes, to try to experience it through the stories of a couple of survivors. I'm not going to take too long, but if we can have it on the screen, I mean, that'd be great. And I know the stage, the writing is in Greek, but I will try to. I want to tell you this story. So we have young Maria. She's 16 years old from Bulgaria. She's coming out, she's turning 17, she's coming out of the orphanage, and she meets Nico, 25-year-old guy, falls in love with her, classic lover boy scenario. A couple of weeks later, he brings her to Greece, in Thessaloniki. He brings her to Greece. They stay with an older lady that is Roma heritage, both of them. Roma heritage, the old lady here in Greece. They stay in that apartment. They can't find jobs, so eventually, 2 months later, she passes them on to her son-in-law, who lives more centrally in the area of Vardaris, right, a few blocks away from our courthouse. And he's having now, so she's now staying with them, and she realizes that this guy owns three stories of that building, and he has eight women there that are working on Yanitson Street. But the guests, and they're coming here, and Roma communities, they're kind of pretty used to the crime of crime-committing kind of fellas in their community, so it's a little bit, she doesn't judge, she doesn't leave, you know, she just goes with it. Until one day she wakes up, Nico's gone, and she's asking where he is, and apparently he had issues with the mafia, and now he's fled back to Bulgaria, and he borrowed some money that she needs to stay back and repay. I'm not surprising anyone so far, am I? Like, we all know this story. Now, I want to put that in a frame of this graph here, and what we're trying to show with this is this. You can take that as a graph of consent or willingness. And I'll tell you, so Maria, this is on the horizontal axis, we have the time, and then maximum, minimum, the vertical one. Maria, until this point, she's before zero. Trafficking hasn't occurred. But at this point, she's like, no, I don't have a job, I can't repay you. She's like, well, we have a job for you. Like, no, I'm not doing that. Like, I never signed up for this. I've never done this before. I don't want to do it. And then she gets beaten and raped, and for weeks she's denied food. She's locked in her room without even access to the bathroom. And sometimes she wakes up from her beating, and she has that old lady that hosted her in the first house over her saying, My sweet little child, why do you do that? They will kill you. These guys are crazy. Like, look at the other girls. They have their drugs. They have the cocaine. They have their cigarettes, their alcohol, highly valued things in their culture. Why don't you just cooperate? Why don't you work with them? Like, is it, why do you choose to live like that? Time goes on. Maria eventually ends up on the street. If Maria is arrested. The police has information on this guy, goes in, busts the whole thing, takes all eight women in the headquarters, and they identify this one as a survivor of human trafficking. At the court case, the lawyers of the opposition, the lawyers of the trafficker, walked up to Maria and said, you look like 55 kilos, like how much do you weigh? And you're fit, you always like that fit? Yes. How could this woman, this older woman, how could she be supervising you on the street? Was she holding you from your hair? What, did she have you chained on her? Like, you could just take two steps and run, and you would never, like, she'd never catch you. How are you saying that, you know, they were keeping you? So Maria then said the story that even we didn't know, which we had spent 6 months with Maria, and then 2 years until the court case came about, that she was in our care in Bulgaria, because our organization works there, too. So she said that one day I had enough money in my pocket, and I tried to run away, and I crossed the street, and I go to the train station, and I just, all of a sudden, I just woke up with a huge headache at the bus station, or asked the bus station, whoever is from Thessaloniki, that's just by the train station, and a guy, an Albanian man that I have never seen in my life, who just hit me in the head and told me that to go back to my trafficker, because they're watching me at all times, and if I try to escape, I'll be broken again, and I'll be beaten, and I'll be dead. Now, I went through the story quickly, but I want us to put that in this framework. So, stage before zero is before the actual trafficking occurred, before the first time of exploitation. And then what happens is this. The toughest thing to identify in human trafficking is the means of exploitation, right? The law says that all these means, threat, force of threat, violence, threat of violence, vulnerable situations, whatever it is, the means that a trafficking ring will use, they're using it to gain the consent of a victim. So we have a victim that's consenting, and now we're going to look at how this consent is manufactured, or how it can be manufactured. And what we see is, so I'll describe this axis now, and then we'll go with the story. As the time goes on, we see the red line, which is the use of means of exploitation, right? And I want to tell you this, it's a little harsh, but who here has a puppy, has a dog? Does anyone? Awesome. Have you guys trained it to give you its paw or do things? You have. What method did you use? Who am I talking to? I think you lifted your hand. Yes. Yeah.
For my dog to do what?
Sorry? To give you, does he give you your paw? Can you ask him, like, give me your hand and?
To give him something.
Right? You give him something, right? If you don't give him anything, will he still do it? Now it will,
yes.
But initially it didn't. What is consistent and what's true with every victim of human trafficking we've encountered is this. In the initial stage, she's been beaten about or raped or whatever it is consistently to show her the behavior they want from her. And then as the time goes on, then they don't need to use that anymore so much because now it's becoming a second nature. Humans adapt, and that's what happens. Now the problem, if the means of exploitation is the toughest thing to identify, then here, it's so easy, man. Like, stage one, it's what we call the breaking stage. You don't need to be an expert to identify a victim of breaking stage. She'll come out to you asking for help. A person was trafficked in Aristotle Square. She pretended to go with a customer, ran to the police station, and in minutes, they had arrested everybody, went to the house, found another girl kept there. She's breaking stage, she's crying, she needs help, she's fighting. Next stage is the stage of trialing. It's the stage of where you. The point is this: in stage one, here, if you look at the blue line, this is the exposure to the public eye. How many people will ever see that woman? And that's minimum. That's zero. So what happens here is this: when the crime is the most obvious, nobody sees it. It's done in a village in Kastoria with the meat shop owner of the village dressed in a police uniform, raping the woman, telling her that we're the police and wherever you go, you're going to go back to us, so you better behave or you're dead. Nobody sees that. Nobody identifies it. But the goal is to bring her to the prophet. And back when nobody sees it and where the only customer that would go with is that pervert that he doesn't mind that she's a trafficked victim, there's no money. There's only a few of those. But there's these thousands that if their conscience is okay that this is a willing prostitute, they'll actually go and they'll pay for it again and again. So you want to bring that person to that stage. I'm not going to take too much time. I think you get the point, and this is a six-hour seminar we do to the police here. But as the time goes on, the person is very obvious but unidentifiable. We started thinking about this model when we noticed that we had survivors that were identified by the police and rescued. They were characterized by the public prosecutor in Greece. And they had been through the authorities for 5 and 6 and 10 times. They had a booklet of working for, so there were so many social workers, police, medical personnel, like that came in contact with them while they were victims of human trafficking, but yet they didn't identify them. And what was the question that sparked all this was, did they miss the mark? Were they not educated enough? Why did she not ask for help? And you notice I'm talking about women because 80% of the survivors we have assisted are women. We have assisted men, victims of labor trafficking predominantly in Greece. A lot of men from Bulgaria, a lot of young boys looking for agriculture jobs. But 8% of the people that we assisted were women. So now, just a short example before I move on is this. We had a survivor that was identified after years of being working in prostitution in Greece. Stage one is breaking, stage two is trialing or testing, stage three is stabilization, and stage four is the stage where we say that there's no way back. In stage three, a victim usually has gotten enough benefits now that sometimes they are the ones supervising the new ones. This specific woman, she was accused for human trafficking before, along with her trafficker, because she took his side in the previous court. So she has now a felony charge against her for human trafficking. How much time do I have? 10 minutes, okay, good. So she's already in this position. She's living with the trafficker in his villa. She can choose shifts. She can choose who is the guy who is she's gonna pass on to some new one because she doesn't want him. And as long as she's doing okay, she can have money for cocaine, money to send back home to her family, expensive clothing and all that. She cannot save money, which is something that is actually noteworthy, because often we see women that have an iPad, an iPhone, and 600 euros in their pocket, but no bank account. And they're allowed to send money back home because that keeps them even more addicted to the trafficker for survival. And it passes the, and then that's a transition that I wanted to mention about this. When you see the means of exploitation as they go down, what also goes down is the attempt of escape. Because that means we train her now, so now she's trained, she doesn't need beating, therefore, she's not reacting, she's not trying to escape. But what also rises with the exposure to the public eye is the difficulty of identification. So what we see identified in Greece is this, predominantly. Like in the last 9 years, we have assisted about 350 victims of human trafficking, but through our shelter, about 150 women. And predominantly, you'll see this. You'll see stage two people that were randomly rescued or escaped. Because what happens is, is anybody here that's a psychologist or somebody who could fill us in on the stages of grief? I'll do it, it's fine. I just thought maybe I'll have an expert do that for me. But you may be familiar with them, you may have heard them. You start from denial, you go to anger, right? And then you go to depression, and then you go to bargaining, compromising, stabilization, to get all the way to acceptance. And if you run that parallel, you'll find denial is just happens at the point zero. The moment they told her, like, that's what you need to do, she's like, no, like, I'm not doing that. She thought she had another choice. So then she goes into breaking. What she does is she fights. Now she fights because she's going through this anger. She fights, but then, and that's the trick in getting that training to work, is when she fights the most, she needs to be beaten the most. She needs to encounter the means of exploitation that will communicate the harshest message, which usually violence is one of them, or threat of violence and all that. As it goes on, what we see is, we see the methods change. We see that as in stage two, you don't want her to be beaten. She goes into depression now. So you beat her until she has no fight anymore. She goes into depression. So then, have you ever encountered, I don't know if you ever had an instance with depression in your family or your circle of friends, and you see people sometimes when they're in depression, they're very, it's kind of like, you can do whatever you want. They just don't care about stuff. And if they find alcohol, they'll take it. And if they just become easy to manipulate and easy to put out with supervision. In this instance, on the street. In some other instances, in a bar with three or four of the older girls supervising them, making sure that if it happens that through her depression, she has a wild day of fight again and she wants to escape like the other girl did, you're there to remind her, hey, you may be going through trialing now, but there's nothing for me to take you back to breaking if you misbehave. Like you would do with your dog. Sometimes, you know, it's kind of like, sometimes he doesn't, then you need to remind him, hey, when you give me that, then I'll give you this, and then you remind him back. In stage three is usually when they now have found compromise, because they're bargaining. They're trying to find their life into this jungle that they're now in. They decided that there's no getting out of this, so they're trying to find what it is. This woman was identified after 11 months of going to the police station every month to show presence for a pending trial against her for human trafficking. And yet she did not ask for help. And the only time she asked for help was 11 months later when she knew that the previous victim that had gone to care, that there was the victim that was, the charges was also against her, she was in the same club where the person was identified, right? It's a little confusing story. Hopefully you're tracking with me. So she found out that this person was referred to our care. And now a year later, the trafficker who is like all powerful and almighty and all connected in Greece and he knows everybody, he hasn't gotten her back. Maybe there is some kind of other option, right? Maybe there is, because the fear has controlled her so far. So now there is maybe that. We have a police officer that, because he was so engaged in this case, every month he tried consistently to care for her and to say, I want to identify, you work with us and we'll help you. Like, you know, which usually we don't have, unless she was charged for trafficking, going there every month, we would never have that opportunity. But she did have that opportunity. And also some of the other girls that were rescued previously had returned back to the city that this happened, the city of Larissa. And they had returned back because they were advanced stages. They were stage three, stage four. They were rescued, but then they went back to work. They got re-trafficked of one way or another. But they went back and they said, the rumor was spread that in Thessaloniki there is a house. And there's some, because they only stayed with us for a couple of days before they left. They said, there's some kind of Georgian mafia that protects this woman that they get out of here. The police takes them to a house and there's some kind of mafia that protects them. That's what they thought we were. But all of a sudden, this person now, stage three, she's been there for years, since she was 16, twice attempted to commit suicide. She's been working there for so long that now she's a manager. She has the conditions of having somebody being regularly in her life and gaining her trust, seeing that somebody else had another option, and all of a sudden what happened 11 months from the date of the first case? She got beaten because she disobeyed. So all of a sudden, she goes back from stage three to stage one, and then she's like, well, I may as well try it. And that's where she goes to trial. She takes a second phone, there's a police operation, they record her, his transactions and all that. They take him down again, they bring 60 women that he had in the area into the police station in Larissa. And yet, only this one is identified. But there was a 2012 and 2013 case. It at first degree, it arrived in court last May, in 2015 in May, where he himself and his wife were charged with human trafficking. His wife, 20 years ago, trafficked to Greece, Romanian woman. He used to work for another trafficker. They developed a relationship, they had a kid, he pulled her out of it, and they became the traffickers themselves. 20 years later, she could not identify with the victim. She had already done this for hundreds of women. Because this guy goes in jail and because the victims keep coming back to court with representation, which is unheard of, and his lawyers were just blown away by the fact that the survivors would come back 2 years later to testify, and three, a week before the trial, after all the postponing and all that, he goes there and he gives up the name of his recruiter, which is a fake employment agency in Athens that the police has estimated that has trafficked more than 1,000 women to Greece. I think, now I'm gonna close here and I'm gonna bring it back, but I think us understanding how this works, understanding that the person we have across from us might be in stage two or stage three, it affects how we need to respond to it. And that's the only way we can really kind of bring this to start fighting this in a proper way. Unless we see it from the eyes of the traffickers, and unless we see it from the eyes of the survivors, we won't be effective in actually fighting it. Now, to bring it to the last season in Greece and what we have done with this. First of all, this is a model we trained the police, but also any frontline professional in the camps in the last season. In the last season, we realized this, that when it comes to the refugee and migrant population, you will find three categories of people. One, all of them are vulnerable. All of them are at risk of being trafficked. So there needs to be some basic prevention and awareness. They need to understand human rights. They need to understand what the dangers might be. What could you encounter in the journey? We're not here, and as NGOs, we're not here to prevent them from trying smuggling or try to go into another country and all that. We have but what we need to tell them is, this has happened to another person. Make sure that somebody knows where you are. Make sure you're not just relying on one person. Make sure, simple things that you would tell to your kids if they were to travel from a country to another. There's another group of people. There's the people that are recruited to trafficking, but they haven't been trafficked yet. And that's where a lot of the minors fit. When the minors fit our borders, most of the times they're still going with the promise of an aunt or an uncle or somebody from their own community that will give them a better life in Germany or in Austria or whatever it is. We were in Crete doing a police training, and at the same time they had identified a man from Congo that was traveling with a minor and a valid French ID of another person. And they were crossing the borders. The picture obviously didn't match, but they were hoping that they will make it through. And the 12-year-old said that her 17-year-old sister has gone there 2 years ago, and now she's a model, but she's going to go and become a doctor. You cannot identify that person. If they didn't find that valid ID, if they didn't find that this was a mismatched ID, they would have gone through, and there's nothing you can do to tell this girl to make sure that to identify her in the spot, because she hasn't seen the other side. She's before zero. So in those, I think a system that actually keeps track of that, a system that keeps a follow-up, what happens with these cases, where they're going, I think that's the most important thing. And awareness and education, again, on what is your rights and what can you do. A lot of the times people are staying in this situation because they don't know the way out. They don't know that with human rights law in Europe, you can actually, even if you've committed an illegal crime or a crime or whatever, you can still be protected by the law. You don't need to be afraid. They don't know that. Some basic stuff like that actually help. We have developed material in video in 8 languages, in brochures in 6 languages, and we have developed comic books with no words at all, just for kids in order to just see and get an idea of that might happen. I need to keep my documents on me. Whatever is the advice that we can give and prevent these people. And the third group of people are those, and we've seen that a lot. We've seen victims stage 3. That have started the journey from the country, they have been trafficked along the way, and now they're either passing hands to the next trafficker, or they escaped and run away and still are vulnerable, and we need to identify those ones. For this is why we have launched this last year in 2016. We did 31 frontline professional trainings all over the camps in Greece to equip identifiers with just understanding just the basic stuff of human trafficking, what kind of flags, how can you make conversation, a more extensive training on how can you see signs. And then gave them the tool of our hotline to call for identification assistance and even further assistance for the survivors. We've been able to identify 19 survivors through the camps in Greece, 19 victims of human trafficking that have been trafficked along the journey. In terms of the measurable success of our awareness campaign and all that, we've seen that we've seen people that came through the camps were brought to awareness of human trafficking, what may happen to them through our awareness projects. Then they still ended up in Athens with their contacts, whoever they were going to traffic them across or move them across Europe, and they got trafficked there, and then they actually went to escape. They knew that this is wrong. The first time they went to a medical clinic of an NGO, they asked for help, and they were actually rescued, and prosecution happened. So this is the three key demographics that I would say we've seen in the recent irregular migration crisis. And I started with all this basic information because I don't see it to be any different than what it was all these years ago. It hasn't changed, it just broadened. The nationalities of survivors are still the same. It's not like the last couple of years we had Syrian women. It's more like we had more Dominican, more Moroccan, more Eritrean, more Nigerian. The vulnerability factor hasn't changed. All of them are still vulnerable, but the ones that are being trafficked through these channels are the same ones, but with the difference that they're now in larger numbers, because you can only hide 10 people in a creek, but you can hide thousands in an ocean. And that's what kind of the effect that we've seen in these last years. So thank you very much. I think I took a little bit more of my time. I don't think I have any other closing statement. Thank you so much.